America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Sometimes when we step back in our time capsule, as we look to figure out how to better solve problems of the future, I find that nostalgia glosses over past inequities. The benefits, often described, may have only been available to a select few. However, in the case of how neighborhoods, communities, and individuals moved up the rung in the past, we might really want to revisit the old neighborhoods and how, in fact, we develop more affordable housing so that people could live in a duplex or a triplex, or maybe they could find attached housing that could really make it easier for them and their neighbors. Americans need to rebuild community in order to reestablish political consensus and personal relationships. So today, we're going to revisit the old poor side of town for one way back that might move us forward. Stay with us here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Howard Husok, and he's written a book called The Poor Side of Town and Why We Need It. An interesting title, and I know that at the end of your book, I got there, and you pay homage to that wonderful song by Johnny Rivers, The Poor Side of Town. And we all think about that poor side of town, I think, in the context of having grown up in the 50s and 60s, and there was that kind of sense of, you know, them and us, or I was part of perhaps the them. But what were you trying to say by virtue of really extolling the virtues of a poor side of town?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Larry. I appreciate it. I'm trying to rehabilitate the image and the idea of a poor side of town. And I'm promoting the idea that poor neighborhoods can be good neighborhoods and have historically been launching pads for upward mobility. And that happens in the following way. When you have small houses built on small lots, that's the secret to this elusive housing affordability we always seem to be looking for. Density, small houses and small lots, two families, three families, and people can own them, rent out units in them, and use them as launching pads for accumulating wealth. And poor neighborhoods, people have a commonality that we tend to overlook. They share their situation. They form institutions, churches, religious institutions of all kinds, based on being cheek by jowl together and sharing a common situation. And so the poor neighborhood, the poor side of town, has all sorts of collateral benefits, even though we've historically denigrated it.
Now, the restoration of this concept of the poor side of town, as you admit very late in the book, it is admittedly a daunting task. And you talk about two intertwining themes in your book. And one, of course, relates to the fact that there has been a housing reform movement before the government got deeply involved, let's say, in project development, public housing, subsidized housing that goes under a different title and chapter these days and is owned by private landlords, but is subsidized by the government. There's more of that these days, I think, than the old public housing.
Yeah.
But before that, this is the period that you're talking about. So let's focus on that for a little bit. And I know I've visited the Tenement Museum in New York, which celebrates that life. And tell us what was going on then and how we decided to reform it and the impacts of those reforms.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Tenement Museum, which I've visited many times. And I find it a quite ironic museum because it promotes the idea that the tenement, the old law tenement as they were called, with limited light and bathrooms down the hall and shared, that this was now to be rebranded, is being rebranded as the urban log cabin, like Abraham Lincoln's starting point. That is, modest circumstances that are the starting point for a better life, as opposed to the way it was portrayed in the era as a cesspool of poverty and disease in which to which people were consigned forever. It turned out that was not true, but we began to make, through policy, all sorts of reforms to address that, even though it was going to ameliorate itself. And that brings me to your question, which is, what else happened in the American housing market that provided the poor side of town and it made poor people better off? Well, between 1880 and 1930, particularly, this is my golden age of low-income housing, not subsidized by the government. Small units on small lots, many of them multifamily, became the norm all across the country. So in Philadelphia, for instance, where my father grew up in a row home, 299,000 small row houses were built in that period of time. Almost 300,000 people owned them. Sometimes they took in lodgers to meet their mortgages. In Boston, 60,000 people lived in three-family houses, the ubiquitous frame wood three-decker houses of New England. They're not just in Boston. They're all over New England. In Chicago, there were two families side-by-sides. In Oakland, there were bungalows. There were all sorts of regional variations of these naturally occurring affordable housing that served America well. One of my favorite lines is by two early sociologists from Boston, Robert Woods and Albert Kennedy. They wrote a book called The Zone of Emergence. Immigrants emerging from those Lower East Side type tenements into homes that they owned with rental units that allowed them to accumulate wealth. That was going on, and it was a really good thing. And we've forgotten that formula. That's one of the big themes of my book.
How ubiquitous was that which you portray as a prototype that we might even look to again, but there are many impediments, and we need to talk about those, as opposed to being something that certain groups of immigrants came into and knew that they were on their way to another place that wasn't necessarily the poor side of town, or they were determined to do that? And how many people were excluded even from the opportunity that you say those communities were afforded really to make their own way in the American lifestyle?
Well, certainly this was a period of Jim Crow and racial covenants and race-related restrictions of all kinds on where one could live if one were an African-American. And so I celebrate the case of the first great American post-war suburb, Levittown, where the homes, it's hard to believe this in retrospect, they were 750 square feet, really small. And they were affordable because they were small. But there were also bans on black people owning, buying those houses. But there were many, many zones of emergence that were owned and controlled by American black people. And so one of my favorite case studies in the book is that of an area in Detroit called Black Bottom. And it wasn't called that because black people lived there. The French, when they settled Detroit, noticed that this area had this very dark, rich soil, and so they gave it that name. But Black Bottom was an area in which there was a high degree of owner occupancy. There was 300 black-owned businesses. So this was a thriving, dynamic, albeit segregated place. And it fell victim to what I am quite vituperative about in the book, urban renewal, demolition, public housing. Those 300 black-owned businesses were swept away by urban renewal, which came upon us in 1949. And so there were racial covenants, there were deed restrictions in this era before the Fair Housing Law, but black people were thriving as owners and business owners, albeit in segregated neighborhoods.
I think people don't realize, and you did point to it, and I interviewed him some time back, Richard Rothstein wrote this incredible book and talked about some of the limitations on access to housing on the part of African Americans going back to this era. And a lot of it was promulgated by the federal government at the time. And that includes, I think, the Roosevelt administration.
Well, that's the irony, is that there's a contemporary effort today to have government get involved in trying to deal with this legacy of racial restrictions. But it was government that was really crucial in countenancing racial restrictions. There's a wonderful black historian named Jamal Jordan in Detroit. He gives tours of what's left of Black Bottom, and African Americans from around the country take his bus tours because they're so fascinated by what was a successful neighborhood. His line on this, that it was public housing for black people and home ownership for white people, because the FHA was convinced in offering mortgage insurance that if a neighborhood were integrated, its property values would decline because white people would no longer want to live there. That was their logic. And so they redlined. They drew the infamous red lines around neighborhoods where they would not, it was the government, where they would not grant mortgages to black people. So Rothstein's book is a great history. He and I disagree on how we should approach the situation today, but we can talk about that.
Okay. Well, for decades, you say, America has combined demolition and demonization of low-income neighborhoods with regulation and attitudes that impede replacement. So here we move along, and we need housing for people. And there was this concept of more what were called projects at the time, and the government getting more involved. How did the government go from being the ones who actually isolated a lot of people into a lesser position in the housing market to one that tried to, I guess in their own mind, rectify that by offering some opportunities? But explain what you saw in the public housing efforts in that urban renewal time frame.
Well, it's not well understood today, but public housing was a utopian vision by really public intellectuals. There was a famous exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum in New York in 1935, The Vision of Tomorrow, The City of Tomorrow. And public housing wasn't just to be for poor people. It was to be for a large portion of the population. Remember, this was Depression times. They thought the housing market, the private housing market, was going to fail a large percentage of the population, and government would need to provide housing as a kind of a public utility. That was the original vision. And over time, public housing became really the modern day equivalent of the poorhouse, because anybody who had the means decided, well, you know, I don't want to live in a tower in the park. I don't want to live an institutional life that the original proponents believed would be preferable. They believed they could design an environment that was a better environment than one that private housing builders could provide. And, you know, my favorite example here is in St. Louis, famous architect Yamasaki, who also designed the World Trade Center in New York, very ironically, designed a public housing project known as Pruitt-Igoe, 33 high-rise towers, 33 of them. It opened in 1954. By 1971, it had become so decayed and dangerous that it was blown up. It's got to be one of the great failed experiments of public policy ever undertaken.
With those projects really literally, figuratively blowing up, we went to this Section 8 subsidized housing model. We're still in that mode today in many cases. Explain the transition and the way out of the project mode that we were in for that period of time.
Well, that was the Nixon administration, and it seemed like bricks and mortar projects were failing. That was the term they used for them. But there needed to be some politically acceptable replacement. And so the idea, and it was a Republican idea, was that, well, we'll give people what amount to housing stamps, if you will, a housing voucher that allows you to rent on the private market and still have your rent subsidized. I'm quite critical of that as well, and I'll explain why. Just as in public housing, your rent is tied to your income. You pay no more than 30% of your income for rent. Boy, that sounds like a good deal until you start to think about it. As your income goes up, what happens? Your rent goes up. This is a powerful disincentive for earning more money and improving your station in life. Would you or any of your listeners ever sign a lease on an apartment that said, if you earn more money, you pay more rent? But millions of poor people in America today have such leases. And so public housing and its successor, housing choice vouchers, as they're called today, and President Biden's new budget wants to add 200,000 more of them, are a powerful deterrent to accumulating wealth because you can't own anything and you're deterred from earning more money. And so we shouldn't be surprised when African Americans constitute 48% of public housing tenants, notwithstanding the fact that they comprise 13% of the overall population, that there's a great chasm between black and white wealth because ownership of housing, even small houses, is one of the strongest means to accumulate wealth in this country.
The poor side of town and why we need it. Howard Husok is with us, and we're going over the history of housing, public housing, and support for it in America. You talk about, later in the book, unreforming housing, and right. One of the keys also is zoning. And let's be really honest about zoning. It is exclusionary in so many parts of the country today. I know in my own community, well, because of they will use sanitary concerns with wells and septic, but you've got 1-acre lots as the norm, and there isn't a great deal of attention paid to affordable housing, even though in the state in which I live, there is a goal that every community have 10% of their stock as affordable housing. So what do you see happening across the country? Is this unusual? Because we are a suburban nation in many ways.
I think that we're beginning to see the worm turn slightly on this. First of all, you're absolutely right that over time, zoning, which began really somewhat modestly in its goals to separate residential from industrial uses, things like that, has morphed into large lot zoning, larger and larger lot zoning. So some places not only have 1 acre, they have 2 acre and 5 acre zoning. This is the antithesis of affordable housing. And so we shouldn't be surprised that we have rising housing prices. Supply and demand still matter.
What about that? Because we're told that one of the answers is to build more. Now, let's not really talk necessarily about this moment in time when the costs are so high, but in general, why have we not built more housing, during a long stretch of time in, the recent era in America?
Yeah, and by the way, that's especially true in the places where housing prices have spiked the most, California and the Northeast. And that's because zoning basically precludes a lot of new construction. So my approach is in the book is not to, I want to be constructive. It's not enough to castigate suburban zoning laws and their advocates, those who have passed them, as racist or exclusionary. What we have to do is to try to work within political reality. And I think we're beginning to see that occur. Every little planning board in the country, and there are thousands of them, mm-hmm. faces the decision about zoning every week on their agendas. And so over time, gradually, there's beginning to take hold this concept that I mentioned in the book called the missing middle.
Explain that.
Well, there's a missing middle of housing that is not too small but not too big. That is a step up from a city apartment, but it's not a McMansion. And I think that suburban dwellers are beginning to realize, you know what? My children can't afford to live in the town that where they grew up. Police and firefighters and teachers who serve their communities can't afford to live in the communities that they serve. Maybe we need modest homes, that missing middle on the housing ladder, I talk about a housing ladder from small to large, multifamilies included, maybe we need to fill in that missing middle by permitting it to be built. Now, it's important to notice that this is not subsidized housing that I'm proposing. Subsidized rentals, I think, continue to be problematic and are going to be resisted. We have to face the political reality that subsidized housing has left a permanently bad taste in the mouth of many local planning boards. They're afraid that it means high-rise public housing or something like that. But small houses on small lots, on quarter-acre lots, why not? Why not?
Yeah, why
two
not?
Family houses, why not? These are kinds of housing that people would snap up. There would be a market for it, and they should not be anathema to suburban planning boards.
Yeah, I wish. But let me ask you, I mean, seriously, when you do look at it, when you look at the cap that people have for their mortgage interest deduction, you've got about $30.2 billion that the government subsidizes us to go into our homes so that we can encourage home ownership. The annual federal tax expenditure is more than the funding of all rental subsidies and public housing combined. I mean, do we have to look at the incentive structures that we put in place to encourage communities and municipalities and states to really buy into a concept where these missing middle, or what they call, I think, upzoning, which you do refer to later
yes.
on in the book, these new neighborhoods that have a collection of different array of housing. I'm looking at a graphic here from an article that was in a magazine called Curbed. And there it is. You've got, you know, the old duplexes. You've got a little bit of a mid-high rise. You've got three across. You've got parking in front, on the side. I mean, a whole range of options. I mean, I know even in some communities where people are trying to bring their elderly back into the neighborhood and have them in separate little pods in the backyard, there's objection even to that.
Well, there is objection, but the state of California just legalized them statewide.
Mm.
So we're beginning to see the worm turn on this.
Okay.
And the case is going to have to be made. I know Vermont once passed a law that was going to state government control zoning, and eventually that was repealed. The struggle for more naturally occurring affordable housing is going to have to be waged local planning board by local planning board. When William Levitt built Levittown, the iconic post-war suburb of little boxes, that housed a heck of a lot of people. He went to the local planning board on Long Island. They said, well, no, your houses don't have any basements, so we're rejecting your whole plan. He came back a little while later with a room full, hundreds of World War II veterans who were stuck in crowded apartments in Brooklyn and demanded that the planning board change its vote, and they did. We need builders and potential owners and tenants to go to these planning boards and say, you're not serving us well, and they need to be local residents and their children. It's going to have to be a fight that's waged planning board by planning board. But I think, again, we're beginning to see change because people realize that exclusionary zoning excludes.
In the last few years, this upzoning legislation has been introduced or passed in California, Oregon, Washington, Seattle, Minneapolis, Nebraska, Virginia, Maryland, and the federal government. I recall, I think it was toward the end of the Obama administration, he had been talking about pressing local governments to relax zoning laws to prohibit, that do prohibit multifamily housing. I know that that was not met well. I mean, there is a lot of resistance out here, Howard. You know that. So what do we do to unlock the possibilities here?
People have to be convinced at the local level that it's in their self-interest to do this. They can't be treated as villains. Their activities can't be characterized as villainous. The case has to be made, and I'm trying to make it in the book, that if you allow modest homeowners to have modest homes, well, they become the next generation of buyers for your home when you're ready to downsize.
Mm-hmm.
And they become the new property owners that are going to support the property values that you rely on. And so unless the case is made that it's in the interest of a community, and you know, every community, I know every 10% and everywhere, every community doesn't have to have its own version, the same version. What we need is some communities will have somewhat smaller houses, some communities will have a little bit larger houses. We need a ladder of housing types, but we need the market to be freed.
And just so people understand, I mean, we are talking about duplexes, triplexes, these accessory dwelling units, apartment
exactly.
buildings, I mean, a whole range of things. By the way, you were on a board in Brookline, Massachusetts. You start off your book talking about that. I mean, what is Brookline? Give us an example, because I want to talk a little bit. We've been talking about the suburbs, which I think is really important. But what about those kind of closer in suburbs? And even what's going on in our urban areas today, where we have seen, like we've seen the pictures in Chicago and other places where, you know, these large projects have come down. Where have people gone who really can't afford housing when those types of things are taken down?
A couple of questions. I'll start with Chicago. In Chicago, it happened, they vouchered out the, as they say, provided a housing voucher to rent on the private market to the tenant of the infamous Robert Taylor homes, which was the subject of a gripping book called There Are No Children Here by Alex Kotlowitz. And they scattered out of the city mainly to relatively low-cost southern suburbs. And it hasn't really worked out very well. I have thoughts about how to do that better. I actually think public housing tenants ought to be bought out. This is my version of reparations, if you will. They were steered into these projects, many of them named for successful African-Americans. They were supposed to be African-American forever. What a crazy idea. A lot of them sit on valuable land. And so I think that we ought to be selling these projects and compensating the tenants, not saying you have to use your voucher for housing. Maybe they don't mind doubling up for a while, saving money. Maybe they want to move somewhere else. Let's give them their agency back, their free choice, not necessarily say, well, we're going to give you housing stamps and you have to use them for whatever landlord might be willing to accept them, which is a limited number. I think we need a much more imaginative approach to how do we disentangle ourselves from public housing in a way that benefits the tenants and the cities. I'm going to have a paper coming out on selling public housing to be published by the American Enterprise Institute sometime in June. But getting back to my time as a member of the town meeting in Brookline, Massachusetts, I once won by one vote. These are really contested elections, believe it or not. They're not open town meetings. You have to be elected. What I learned there was this very progressive town, Brookline is like an uber progressive town, had really a dirty secret past. There was a whole neighborhood of about 300 three-family homes, very working class, Irish American. The town tore it down completely, replaced it with high-rise luxury units and public housing. The whole social structure of that place, owners, tenants who knew each other, extended families, parish, hockey teams, all sorts of things, civil society, that's what gets created by these dense urban neighborhoods of small homes, was swept away. And it was the federal government with the Urban Renewal Act that gave the money to do that. This was classism, if you will, that was the dirty little secret of a super progressive town. And when I found out about that, because as a town meeting member, I still had to vote to pay some of those bills, I said, what was that all about? Because it had happened before my time. It was one of the inspirations for writing the book, that mistake. Hmm.
What about the urban areas? I mean, let's talk about Boston. My daughter lives in Boston. I mean, talk about an expensive area to live. And New York and Austin and San Francisco and all of these really attractive places for young people. And yet, how do you get a start there? You've got rentals that are skyrocketing. You've got a limited amount of housing. We know, even in the course of this terrible Ukrainian war, that many of these oligarchs and LLCs and other have bought up a lot of real estate in some of these really attractive communities. So what's happening in our urban centers, and how do people afford to even live there?
Well, many people can't, but I think we're seeing there's going to always be expensive neighborhoods and less expensive neighborhoods. And if we hit our heads against the wall saying, how do we make Beverly Hills affordable? Our heads are going to get very sore that way. We're going to get a terrible headache. There's always going to be this stratification. It's the character of housing markets. But I think we're seeing, with the pandemic, an incredible reshuffling that's going on. And so there's a terrific paper out of the Dallas Fed that's showing that people are moving to affordable cities all around the country because they can work remotely. This is a game changer. It's accelerated something that was already occurring, like so many of the pandemic trends, but it really is happening. And not only that, but poor people are benefiting from that, because in the cities to which relatively middle class people are moving, suddenly there's more demand for services, and poorer people in those neighborhoods can provide those services. So this great reshuffling, which I think is happening, is just on the precipice of being understood, and I think is going to change things for your daughter and my kids too.
Yeah. Well, when you say agency, I mean, there are certain people who really can move out. And I love your concept where the middle class moves out because they can work anywhere. Now, with all the jobs that are wanting and looking for people, one of the great benefits that employers are allowing is to say you can work wherever you want. And I know that there are communities in the Midwest who are giving people subsidies to move there because they are not tethered to some of the large urban centers. But what about the service worker who still wants to serve people in Boston or wants to serve people in New York? Honestly, Howard, when I go into New York, I'm wondering, that guy who's selling me, you know, a pretzel on the street corner, where does he have to go to live that night?
Well, I think one of the things that we're seeing happen is that as the great reshuffle that I'm talking about, drawing people out of the center cities into near-in suburbs and into other cities altogether, other metros altogether, New York, San Francisco lost huge amounts of population to Florida and Texas. So prices will go down. May take a little while, but they will go down. But to the extent that middle-class denizens of New York also move to the near-in suburbs, well, those service workers can go to those suburbs for the day. My favorite example of that is, this is a Boston example, in Chinatown in Boston, every morning there are vans that take cooks all over New England to serve Chinese restaurants. And so the Uberization of transportation makes it possible for service workers to go to places they couldn't reach before. And that Uberization includes small vans and buses. So things are changing.
Yeah, just the way you were talking about housing and getting more creative and innovative, the movement of people, transport is such a key element to all of that as to what your fortunes and where you have to live or can live are really available to you. In all of this, are you hopeful? Because, I mean, you sound like a hopeful guy. And yet you
try.
No, and you bemoan, you know, a lot of the changes, and you want to go back to, you know, communities that really feel like they're intact. How are you feeling, you know, in this era? And what are some of the other trends? Because that's what we try to deal with, social and political trends in the country. Where do you see us moving? And do you think the pandemic is really that great reshuffling that maybe nothing else would have accomplished had it not happened?
Yeah, wars and disease historically really matter in history, don't they?
Mm.
And, I mean, what did the Black Death do to Europe? Oh, suddenly wages went up because there weren't very many people left. So, yeah, I think this great reshuffling and a change in the value of housing in cities. I was born in Cleveland. I still have some friends there. And they tell me that across the street, some tech guys from San Francisco just bought a mansion and it cost them a few a few hundred thousand dollars. They couldn't buy a parking space in San Francisco for that. But Facebook says, yeah, okay with us, work from anywhere. So we have yet to see the full impact of this. And I'm seeing definitely a hopeful trend with the emergence of even the term missing middle. One of the first things that has to happen before something changes is you have to have a term about what the problem is. And so even the fact that that term is extant gives me hope. Now, I do worry about how the argument is made. I think it's got to be sold not as punishment, but as cure. So, for instance, in Minneapolis, and I wrote about this for the City Journal magazine, the city council rolled back single-family zoning, and they did it in the name of, well, it's all been racist, and this has been such a racist city. Well, actually, single-family zoning was a minor part of Minneapolis, and if you tell people that they're racists, they're going to not take that too well. And Minneapolis's architecture and its design of its housing market is not that different from many other cities. It's got a lot of two-family, three-family, small apartment buildings. But the message to the suburban areas where there is exclusive single-family zoning is, we're coming for you. And that's a bad message. We have to tell people, look, you're going to have a better community if you have a range of housing types. More people who will serve your community will be able to live there. That's got to be the message. And to the extent that a missing middle message like that is framed optimistically, then I think it'll be successful. Whether it will be or not, you know, I do try to be optimistic and hope that that's happening.
Let me, in closing, try to help frame this, and I need your perspective. The National Low Income Housing Coalition says that there are 6.8 million more affordable housing units needed for extremely low income families. I don't know if you accept that number, but we have seen numbers like that. We keep hearing that a higher percentage of people's income of late has been going toward their housing. So with that said, if we were really trying to ameliorate that issue in the near term, what's the quickest way to do that in your mind, looking at trying to fill that middle, encourage people to have ownership? Because the other trend that I'm seeing is that more people are renting these days than buying in our country, and the American dream is predicated on the home. And as you said earlier, the differential between black and white families is often because of the inability to really get a home of your own. So where do we go in this near term?
Well, progress will be incremental. And as I said before, it will happen planning board by planning board. Making the case for a massive federal infusion of housing subsidy funds, which is not going to happen. The Build Back Better proposed $65 billion for public housing, and that wasn't taken seriously, and it's been dropped even from the new Biden budget. I happen to think that one of the reasons we're seeing this quote-unquote demand for need for low-income housing is we've had such a ballooning of the number of small households. We once had, like about 1960, there were 19 million individual households. Now there are 38 million individual households. People are living alone. There's an explosion of single parenthood. And housing subsidies has the unfortunate effect of accommodating that. And so I happen to hope that if we have small houses which are in the reach of modest two-person families, I'm trying to say maybe husband and wife could be any two-person family, any configuration, that will encourage the formation of two-parent families as opposed to these subsidies which go to the most impoverished by rule and encourage this wave of household formation. If we're going to accommodate as many single persons as possible, yeah, we're going to need more and more subsidies, but I don't think that's actually a good approach.
And one more. You're really in touch with private markets and really are a proponent of leaving as much in the private sector as possible. What about the National Home Builders Where do they stand? They've been building these McMansions. What's the incentive on these cluster and the various different manifestations that you and I mentioned? Do they buy into that? Is that more lucrative for them? Or do they want to keep building these McMansions?
In New York, you see high-rise luxury towers built because that's the return. That's where you can get a return on your investment. So much of the city is rent-regulated that there's a limited investment, and so it is with home building. You build what you're allowed to build, and if you can only build one house on 5 acres, what are you going to build? A McMansion. That's the best return on investment that you can get. And so we can't expect home builders to build what they're not allowed to build or to take a risk on that. I do hope that the home builders will come forward as a lobby group for missing middle. And I think we're beginning to see that. They understand that the more housing you can build on the same footprint, well, the better your return on investment. They know that. And so they're going to have to, just as William Levitt did when he made the case for the planning board on Long Island in 1948, they're going to have to make that case too. Otherwise, the National Low Income Housing Coalition is going to be the only voice.
Interesting. Well, let's be honest, there's not a more important topic to the average American than their shelter, their dwelling, their home. And I like the way you do present it in the book, that a home ensconced in a wonderful community setting, which has thriving small businesses, that has a community sense about it. We have lost some of that, too, in America for a whole host of reasons, and I'm sure you've read time and again Bowling Alone. So there are things that housing can help to bring back together. But as you say, it's a road, and it's an incremental one, and hopefully we're starting that journey. The Poor Side of Town and Why We Need It. Howard Husak, you've given us something to think about, and I thank you for that here on America Trends.
I appreciate you having me on, and a lot of great questions and hard questions. So thanks so much.
Good. Thank you.